Hello and welcome to the Classicist Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, here with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, keeping with our string of recent historical episodes, we turn today to the Treaty of Versailles and the end of World War I. It all happened 100 years ago this summer, and you wrote a piece about it recently for American Greatness. And I'll just start you with this. The shorthand explanation that you often get of the Treaty of Versailles is that its mismanagement led almost inevitably to World War II. Its mismanagement and its core terms. The idea being that the terms imposed on Germany at the end of World War I were so harsh and the cost of the reparations they had to pay so great that it was an invitation for the Germans to feel aggrieved. This is the famous John Maynard Keynes line that it was a Carthaginian peace. And you say in this piece that you wrote for American Greatness that that is not necessarily the right way to understand it. Make that case for us.
Well, it's not only the right way, the wrong way to understand it, but it was considered, at least by the parties other than the Americans, as flawed from the beginning. But to answer your question more specifically, we usually think that Versailles was punitive because it took territory away from Germany and made them pay reparations, and it had the so-called war guilt clause that blamed Germany for starting the war. But there was nothing wrong with any of that. A lot of the territory that Germany lost, there were territorial claims by other countries such as Poland and Czechoslovakia that were just as valid as German claims under the reunification program. And of course, Germany did start the war. They did invade. And second, they didn't really pay reparations as was planned. They inflated their currency to pay them off in cheap marks, knowing that that risked devastating inflation, but at least it would punish the British and the Americans, indirectly the Americans, because they had to be paid off by the British and the French for their war loans. So it in some ways led to the Great Depression. But more importantly, one way to judge it is look at contemporary treaties. And one of them, of course, was the treaty that Germany and Bismarck imposed on France at the end of the so-called Franco-Prussian War in 1871. It was much harsher. It took away the Alsace-Lorraine. It imposed a huge indemnity payment to Germany. And then we know from that weird September program plan to annex parts of France in 1914. Remember that before the miracle on the Marne, Germany almost got to the Atlantic Ocean. And the idea was that the Kaiser, following, I think his name was Kurt Reisler, he was a professor, and he drew up an idea that you would destroy completely Belgium and annex it to Germany, and then you would take the French Atlantic coast and let Germany have permanent ports there and really annex them, and then you would make France pay for the cost of the war, much harsher again than the Versailles Treaty. And then finally, of course, there was the March 1918 treaty that Germany imposed on the new Soviet government in 1918. And that was that annexed 50 million people in European Russia and over a million square miles and made this collapsed Russian government, the Tsarist government and the White Russian government, and then the communist governments, that whole succession of failures, they made them pay an enormous war reparations to Imperial Germany. So we have to take all of that into consideration when we look at what followed at Versailles, and then with a little footnote that by any measure, what we imposed, we being the Allies after World War II, imposed on Nazi Germany made Versailles look like a picnic. We went in and occupied the country. We split Germany into four zones, which eventually became East and West Germany. We forbid them to have a military force. We forcibly later put them in NATO. We made sure they could not have nuclear weapons, and we still have 30,000 troops there today. So taking all that together, it's kind of hard to believe that what caused World War II was an anger over the unfairness of Versailles. It's more likely an anger on the part of Germany that they lost the war, and then appeasement on the part of the exhausted democracies that never wanted to repeat World War I again, obviously, but didn't fathom that Germany most certainly did want to repeat it, just change the result.
As we go through these centennials of World War One, the war is getting a lot more attention in the wider culture than it has for a long time. There was this documentary put out by Peter Jackson earlier this year called They Shall Not Grow Old. There's a scripted film that's coming out at the end of the year called 1917. And yet that extra attention doesn't necessarily bring any more narrative clarity. You and I talked on a recent show about how Americans have a fixed and pretty positive understanding of World War II. With World War I, however, you often just hear it described as this tragic accident, and oftentimes it's sort of essentially pointless. All these countries and empires stumbling blindly into war because they felt bound by these anachronistic alliances. What's lost in that characterization? What do we need to understand about World War I that we don't?
Well, what we need to understand is that since 1870, Germany had had the largest economy in Europe, and it led France and Britain in almost every category of industrial production. And it had a much more advanced army. It created the whole idea of a general staff in terms of artillery, company organization, officer corps. It was superior to France. And, of course, Britain had emphasized the Navy. And so there was really no way to deter Germany on the continent. And then when you add to the fact that Germany felt with this newfound wealth and power that followed a rather late unification, it was the last big country in Europe to be formed in 1871, that it had missed out on colonialization, so it didn't have a lot of territory in Asia or in the New World or in Africa. And so it had a sense of, well, we're stronger than you are now, but we want more stuff, and you've got to give it to us. And unfortunately for Britain and France, they didn't have the wherewithal to say the Germans were not going to do it. And more importantly, if you try to force your way into our countries, you're going to pay a dear price because of they had no way to deter the German army. And so they thought they did by having a blockade of Germany with the British Navy. And they had this idea that France and Britain together had a greater population than Germany, but they didn't. Neither one had the military traditions on land that Germany did. And so it was a sense that Germany thought they could have a quick war and repeat what they had done in 1870-71, about a year and a half, take a lot of territory, this time, as I said, annex a lot of areas like Belgium and the west coast of France, and pay a very small price. And they almost pulled it off, except for the French counterattack in autumn of 1914, they would have pulled it off. But it was an idea that nobody had deterred them in an earlier war 45 years earlier, and they were going to do it again, and they were going to be successful again, and then France and what was left of France and Britain would have to deal on their terms.
How should we think about the American role in World War One? You famously have Woodrow Wilson run for re-election in 1916 on the fact that he kept us out of war before he brings us in pretty early in his second term. At the other sort of extremes, you had people like Teddy Roosevelt, who by then is a former president, but he's pretty gung-ho about American involvement. In fact, wants to go over there himself. Or opposite extreme, William Jennings Bryan, who actually resigned as Wilson's Secretary of State because of his opposition to American involvement. And resigned, we should note, years before there was any actual American fighting, just when he thought the diplomacy was getting too tough. So did the U.S. make the right decision by getting involved? And if so, did we do so on the right timeline?
I think we had to get involved because there would not be a Europe as we know it today had we not. But we had the wrong timeline. By that I meant, had Wilson and had Roosevelt and Wilson earlier and Taft, all of them, Taft and Wilson and Roosevelt, had they armed in 1914, had they had a kind of alliance of the type we have today, then Germany would have looked at invading France in a very different way, because it might have involved the entrance 2 years earlier, 3 years earlier, of the United States. The same situation applies to the invasion of France in June 1940. Had they invaded then and understood the United States would be there or was already there, they wouldn't have done it. And people say, well, we didn't have the wherewithal. Well, we did very quickly. And by that I mean, once we declared war in April 1917, within a year, we had 1 million men and didn't lose any of them and landed them in France, and we'd eventually have 2 million. And we were producing more artillery shells, to take one example, than France and Britain put together within 2 years. So had we just done that 2 years earlier, I think we could have prevented a war. Then I think you've got to give us credit that the British and French armies were exhausted by March 1918. We were gearing up to be a fully combative partner, but more importantly, Russia was knocked out of the war. So there were 500,000 German soldiers that were being transferred to the Western Front. And had the Kaiser and Bismarck and Ludendorff not been so greedy, they could have taken another 1 million soldiers that were in occupational duty in what was now conquered Russia and put them on the Western Front. And the idea was to push out to the Channel and cut off the British from the French as they tried in 1914, and they do it again in 1940 before the Americans could do much about it. And they almost pulled it off. But we did. The point I'm making is our contribution is we stopped that. The spring offensive failed. And then we made a tragic error, and that was attributable to the Americans. That is, in the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918, when we had this armistice, there was no surrender. There was no unconditional surrender. It wasn't even a negotiated surrender. It was just an agreement to stop fighting. And unfortunately, Wilson didn't understand that they stopped fighting inside French and Belgian territory. And that was a disconnect, because they were exhausted. They were defeated. The army was just about ready to collapse. There was insurrections and revolution back in Germany. Had we just continued the war from November 11th to January or February of 1919, the British and the French and the Americans would have been in Berlin as they were in 1945, or when the Russians were in Germany. We would have occupied Germany, and then there wouldn't have been any they stabbed us in the back, the Jews were responsible narratives that quickly arose. Because remember, the war was over in November of 1918, but we didn't get to Versailles till June of 1919. 70% of the victorious armies had been demobilized. And in that brief 8-month period, the Germans, after being humiliated and begging, you know, Ludendorff was begging to call the whole thing off. Hindenburg was begging to call it off. And then suddenly they looked across the battlefield and then they said, wow, we're in the enemy's territory and they're all quitting. And they went back home and said, we didn't lose. We were just stabbed in the back by you people, the communists and the Jews. And so the idea that Versailles followed, you know, so many months after this armistice was tragic. Had they had an unconditional surrender, and then had they had tough terms and enforced them, there wouldn't have been a World War II.
This may sound strange to some of our listeners, but I'm not making it up. There is a school of thought out there that asks, would it have been so bad if Germany had achieved its war aims during World War I? Yes, you create an expanded empire under the Kaiser, but once you settle into that equilibrium, you do not get a Germany that produces the Nazis and Adolf Hitler. I mean, we've got to run some counterfactuals here, but how do you grapple with that analysis, Victor?
Well, that's not an eccentric point of view. I mean, it's one that I don't agree with and I've attacked before, but it was, I think you could argue, the subtext or maybe one of the principal arguments of our colleague at Hoover, Neil Ferguson's book, The Pity of War, that this was an unnecessary fight between aristocratic classes that were not so much dissimilar as kindred, and it didn't have to take place. And on the other hand, had Germany won very quickly, it had sort of an enlightened, this wasn't Nazism, it had an enlightened social policy. It was one of the first countries to have universal health care. It was arguing, even under the September program, that there would be what they called Middle Europe under German benevolent control, and that there would be sort of a proto-EU. And so we've seen a lot of books and articles that make that case, because what they're trying to say is there was 20 million people killed, civilians and soldiers, in World War I. And they said anything is better than avoiding that. But what I'm trying to suggest why that's flawed is that most of the strains of Nazism didn't come out of the head of Adolf Hitler. In the late 19th century, there was a whole corpus of, I would guess we call it racial genetics, in Germany that argued that Jews in particular were subhuman and that they did not deserve full citizenship. And there was a Prussian nationalist strain that never accepted the results of the war because they felt the war was justified because they were a superior people and they had defeated Russians and they were on the verge of defeating the French and the democracies, and had they done that, it would be a good thing. And so it's very hard, given that mentality, to see how a unified Europe under German control would have been in any way enlightened or liberal at all. It wouldn't have. It would have been maybe not as bad as under Nazi control, but then again, we don't know that because there were strains within German intellectual and cultural thinking that lended themselves to Hitler very nicely. And Hitler was not an aberration. He drew on currents from World War I in the 19th century, and those currents were not enlightened at all.
The final question that I'll put to you, there has been a tendency in recent years, surely only compounded by all these World War I centennials, to draw parallels between global affairs back then and global affairs today. And you'll get a different version of this with every purveyor of it that you talk to, but they all kind of come down to the same core diagnosis, which is that the level of global uncertainty, the rival powers, the potential for miscalculation means that maybe we're sitting on a powder keg like the one the world was on top of in 1914, and that we could, as a result, find ourselves up against another unexpected major global conflict. How much stock do you put in those kinds of arguments?
Well, I mean, human nature is constant across time and space, so there's always a possibility that you could have a World War I or World War II again. I'm not an advocate or a believer that war simply ends because technology radically changes. For every weapon, there's a counterweapon. So yes, we're in a particular era of the offensive dominance with nuclear weapons, but that doesn't mean in 30 years we won't have sophisticated lasers that can't shoot down missiles and whatnot coming in from space, and it'll be a very dangerous type of war. But I can envision in 50 years a return of the defensive that will make nuclear weapons not the end of all wars. So on the technological side, we could have another war that would be like a global war. But what set that war off, World War I, and what set World War II off, there was an ideological difference, and that was democracy versus autocracy or militarism. And today, with the onset of globalization and the Marshall Plan and the occupation of Europe and the rise of the European Union and the defeat of the Soviet Union, the Cold War, when you look at those 20th century red lines or fault lines, you don't see them anymore, at least for now. And by that I mean most of the people in Europe are on the same page, that they have constitutional governments, and most of the people in Asia, South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Australia, the Philippines, are on the same page. And what they're worried about, of course, is China and North Korea, but they don't have, even China doesn't have the wherewithal of the Asian powers and the European powers and the Americans. So it's getting thinner, but still the Western world has a level of deterrence that it did not have in World War I and II vis-a-vis Germany. Then the second thing is, remember the motto of NATO? It was America in, Russia out, Germany down. And I don't want to be too overdramatic, but as long as Germany is not up, we don't have a war in Europe. And by that I mean it's not armed and it doesn't have its economic dynamism harnessed to military ambitions. We have to be a little careful because lately Germany is questioning a lot of the post-war protocols. There are people in Germany that are asking right now why they are not nuclear when France and Britain are, and they're asking, is NATO really worth it when we're getting a lot of our natural gas from Vladimir Putin? And in a recent Pew poll, they, of all the European countries, poll the most anti-American. 52% of Germans do not have a good impression of the United States. And when you look at the EU itself, and I've the last three or four years, I've spent a lot of time in Eastern Europe. They're all angry at Germany because they feel that they're imposing their views on illegal immigration. I've been a lot in Southern Europe. They're all mad at Italy, Spain, Portugal, Greece, because Germany's and the Deutsche Bank are imposing their financial clout on them to repay loans. If you look at Britain, they feel that Brexit would not be a problem if it were not for German intransigence. If you look at America, we say the reason that NATO's not meeting their 2% investments of GDP is because of Germany that refuses to do it and sets the standard for other smaller powers. And so in some ways, is even though it's been 75 years since we've seen Germany up, the people in the past who were worried about it had, 1870, 71, 1914, 1939, they had something. And it goes back to Caesar and Tacitus, that there's something about the German people and the German countryside and the location of Germany within Europe that lends itself to enormous economic power and sometimes a desire to use that power at the expense of its neighbors. So I think we have to watch Germany very carefully. And the same is true with different circumstances with Japan and China. Historically, those two countries have had a tendency to be have an aggrandizement of their neighbors. But as long as the United States keeps its military in a hyper-deterrent fashion, that is, it's so large and it's so extensive and it's so capable that no country wants to challenge us directly, and we have a series of alliances that engage in mutual assistance, even though that's endangered lately. I'm not too worried. What I will be worried about is if Germany becomes nuclear or Japan becomes nuclear or there's a nuclear exchange between Pakistan and India, or China decides that it's not going to have 200 nuclear weapons but 2,000. And so all of this is very volatile, and there's nothing that suggests in history that you could not have another World War I or World War II. I think that we're in danger of thinking that we're in the age of universal democracy and nuclear weapons and we'll never have a war again. That's just not true. Half the 7 billion people on Earth do not live under democratic auspices.
All right. You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read Victor's work at Defining Ideas at hoover.org, as well as at victorhanson.com. And if you enjoy the classes, please rate the show on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.